Hello and welcome once again to the Foundry Church podcast. My name is Joseph. I'm the worship pastor here at the Foundry Church in Winter Springs, Florida, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to this episode. We are in a series right now called Sacred Space, where we're sort of examining the idea of the cosmic Christ, this universal sort of, you know, part of the Trinity that has always existed, that, you know, John says the lens through which all things were created was this Christ, and the person of Jesus who lived and walked among us and was the Christ in flesh and blood, was God made human, fully God, fully man, all of that sort of stuff. We've been looking at some of the I am statements that Jesus made. I am the bread of life. I'm the door. I'm the light of the world, that sort of thing. And this week we're pivoting because it is Palm Sunday. We're taking a look at the triumphal entry of Jesus into Jerusalem and also at the crucifixion. This is all in preparation for this coming Sunday, which is Easter Sunday, where we celebrate the resurrection and this kind of this momentous, you know, occasion in all of human history, sort of the pivot point where, you know, all of a sudden we're able to be brought back into a right relationship with God. We're able to cross the threshold and step into eternity even now. So we're eagerly looking forward to that next Sunday. But for this week, we hope that you enjoy this message on the crucifixion from our lead pastor, Seth Kane.
A statement from Jesus where he says, I am the door. And what we've been doing, in case you haven't been here, up to this point, we've looked at five of the I am statements of Jesus through the lens of this eternal Christ. And so now we begin this like journey towards Easter. It's Palm Sunday, what they call triumphal entry. That's what we're going to be talking about. So today I want to talk about kind of two things as we move towards like this week of Passion. We begin this week of Passion and move towards the crucifixion and the resurrection. I want to break this into two parts. First, we'll be talking about kind of that triumphal entry and looking at that through a larger lens. But then I also want to look at like the crucifixion itself through the lens of the eternal Christ and see what that reveals to us as well. So let's start with the triumphal entry, okay? So that's what we celebrate on a day like today that we call Palm Sunday. We celebrate Jesus coming to Jerusalem to begin this like journey towards the cross. So this story is found in all four of the Gospels, but today we're going to look at it through Matthew. Matthew and his disciple, or Jesus and his disciples, are approaching Jerusalem. Jesus says, hey, go get me a donkey, right? That's where we're at. We continue on. The disciples went and did as Jesus had instructed them. They brought the colt, they brought the donkey and the colt and placed their cloaks on them for Jesus to sit on. A very large crowd spread their cloaks on the road, while others cut branches from the trees and spread them out on the road. The crowds that went ahead of him and those that followed shouted, Hosanna to the Son of David. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest of heavens. When Jesus entered Jerusalem, the whole city was stirred and asked, who is this? The crowds answered, this is Jesus, the prophet from Nazareth in Galilee. So for the people in Jerusalem at this time, there was this great stir with Jesus coming into Jerusalem on a donkey. This comes from a prophecy in Zechariah, but also they had seen and they had heard the miracles. Word was beginning to spread that Jesus was the great Messiah that they'd been waiting for, and he was the one who had come to liberate God's chosen people from the hands of the Roman Empire. But did you know that this wasn't the only triumphal entry on that day? Okay, so stay with me. So Jesus comes into Jerusalem along with his disciples and thousands of other people, because it's the time of the Passover. So everyone is making this pilgrimage to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover festival, which means they're bringing their Passover sacrifices to the temple. This is a huge deal. The Passover celebrates when God rescued Israel from the hands of Egypt. Now, in their book, it was called The Last Week. It was called Last Week by these two guys, Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crusan. They're both Bible scholars and historians. And so what they talk about is how that on Palm Sunday, there would have actually been two triumphal processions, that of Jesus and that of Pilate. Okay, so Pontius Pilate was the Roman governor of Judea. He didn't live in Jerusalem. He spent most of his time working out of a place called Caesarea Philippi. Here's a picture of it, if you can bring that up. This is a great little place up on the Mediterranean Sea. It's on the coast. Like, who wouldn't want to live there? I'd live there too, you know what I'm saying? Now, let's show you a map just to give you some reference point. It's going to be really hard to see up there, but this is a very simple map. Here is Caesarea Maritima, or Caesarea by the sea. Here is Jerusalem. So you can see that it's northwest of Jerusalem. Okay, it's about 60 miles, I think, is what most people say. And so Pilate lived at Caesarea, but then every year around the time of the Passover, when the whole city is filling up with all the Jewish people, he would make his way to Jerusalem as like, just to let people know, like, we're in charge. He'd show up with a bit of a, like, a show of force. In fact, in their book, they talk about Pilate's imperial procession this way. They say this: it was a visual panoply of imperial power, cavalry on horses, foot soldiers, leather armor, helmets, weapons, banners, golden eagles mounted on poles, sun glinting on metal and gold. Sounds, the marching of feet, the creaking of leather, the clinking of bridles, the beating of drums, the swirling of dust, the eyes of the silent onlookers, some curious, some awed, some resentful. So Pilate comes marching into Jerusalem with all of his military might from the west. And so Jesus, at the same time, mounts a donkey and enters the city from the east through what's known as the Golden Gates of Jerusalem. Borg and Crusan have this to say about the triumphal entry of Jesus, and I think this is so fantastic. What we often call the triumphal entry was actually an anti-imperial, anti-triumphal one, a deliberate lampoon of the conquering emperor entering a city on horseback through gates opened in abject submission. Yeah, Jerusalem was forced to open its gates for the Romans. In fact, Crusan notes, he talks about what Jesus was riding the donkey. He says this: Jesus rode the most unthreatening, most unmilitary mount imaginable, a female nursing donkey with her little colt trotting along beside her. Right? Like, so the case that they're making in the book is that that essentially the triumphal entry of Jesus is this peaceful act of intentional protest. That although Jesus was being worshipped as he came to the city, that was not the actual point, that this was actually kind of an act of like political theater. This was a joke at the expense of the Roman Empire. This was an anti-imperial demonstration designed to mock the obscene pomp and circumstance of the Roman Empire. So Jesus is the Prince of Peace, but it's not a static, sit back and do nothing sort of peace. It's an active, it's a dynamic peace that confronts the powers of the day. I mean, this is really quite a funny scene if you think about it. You've got big macho Rome coming in their horse and chariots and armor, and we're in charge and we are in power and you better get in your place and we have the weapons and you are subject to us. And then on the other side, Jesus puts on his own parade with this group of misfits, and he's riding a mama donkey with her baby. Like, that's funny. It's like showing up to the front lines of a war with like a water gun and being like, all right, guys, we're going to do it. Everyone be like, what are you doing? That's not going to work. Rome did not find this funny. Rome did not find it funny. The Jewish people looking for a savior didn't get the joke. Like Hunter mentioned last week, Pilate found no fault in Jesus. And yet when the people had a choice to choose between Jesus being released from prison, Jesus the Prince of Peace, or Barabbas the insurrectionist, they chose to release Barabbas. They refuse the way of peace. And by doing so, they send Jesus to the cross. And it's like Jesus' whole life and ministry, even his death on the cross, it's all pointing to a different kind of kingdom, the kingdom of God, the kingdom of peace. It's all continually pointing to this idea that of the myth of redemptive violence, that violence doesn't bring peace. It only brings more violence. Jesus shows up and he's showing us this other path. He's showing us there's a different way. He came to set us free from being slaves to the things of the world that actually prevent us from experiencing peace and wholeness. Now, of course, anytime that you push back on popular ways of thinking, popular worldviews, long-held cultural beliefs, anything that stands outside of, like, well, this is how we do it, what happens? You get executed, don't you? Whether figuratively or literally in Jesus' case. And so the question for us is, like, which path will we choose? And not only which path will we choose, but will we have the courage to continue to walk it? Jesus is the Prince of Peace, and he's always coming to offer peace and showing us how to live in peace. It doesn't mean you just lay down and take it, but there's different ways. There's a whole term for this called third-way nonviolence. It's these creative elements and ways that you can get your point across, elevate humanity without raising weapons. Now, let's shift our attention to the crucifixion, okay? Because this is the result of Jesus choosing the path of peace and being faithful to it. Jesus is betrayed by Judas. He's arrested. He's put on trial unfairly. Then he has an unfair trial. Then he's sentenced to death on the cross for, like, nothing really, according to the law. He's laughed at. He's beaten. He's nailed to the cross that we might know the love of God. Not that God would change God's mind about us because he already loves us, but rather that we would change our mind about God. The crucifixion answers, like, who is this God? What is this God like? Is this God like all of the others? Is this God creating another kingdom like all the other kingdoms of the world that we've seen that thrive on power and violence? Or is this God different? Is this God creating a different kind of kingdom? This God, through Jesus the Christ, is bringing this end to the violence in and of himself. This God is taking on all of the hurt and the pain and the sin of the world, and on the cross is transforming it into something new and good. Matthew chapter 15, turn with me if you would. I want to look at a few of the, one of the moments of, like, the last few moments of the life of Jesus, what happens after he dies. Mark 15, with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." Now, Matthew and Mark and John, Matthew, Luke, and John, they all have, like, a crucifixion story. But I want to look at Matthew and Luke because they record a detail that kind of puts all these three things together. Luke says this, Luke 22. "It was about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, for the sun stopped shining, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Jesus called out with a loud voice, 'Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.' When he had said this, he breathed his last breath." Okay, here's Matthew. "When Jesus had cried out in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook, the rocks split, and the tomb broke open. The bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared to many people." Now, John talks about this, but he kind of goes in a different direction. It says, "When he had received the drink, Jesus said, 'It is finished.' With that, he bowed his head and he gave up his spirit." Okay, so if you notice, three of the four Gospels mention the splitting of the temple veil, the temple curtain being torn in two. Okay, so I want to talk about the temple for a little bit. Here's a very simple rendering of the temple. It's probably hard for you to see and definitely impossible to read, so I'll just pretend like you can read it and I'll tell you what's happening, okay? So you don't really see much of the outer court, but you have the outer court. This is right here, it says outer court. This is all Levites may enter. Then you go into the temple a little bit further, and you have what's called the holy place here and here. Only the priests from the line of Aaron are allowed to enter into the holy place. And then you go further into the most holy place, which were also called the Holy of Holies, and only the high priest is able to enter here, and that's only once a year. Now, what's interesting about this, and I don't know if you can see it super well, but right here and right here, there are purple lines. Okay, can you see them? Just yeah, say yes, Seth, we can see them. They're purple. I promise there's two of them. So when you read the text and it says the veil of the temple was torn, it doesn't specify which one. And what we see here is that there's actually two curtains, two veils to the temple. Now, for me growing up, I was always taught that when the scripture says the temple veil was torn in two, it was always talking about the inner curtain, the curtain to the Holy of Holies. And so the idea was that God was no longer restricted. There was no longer this boundary, no longer the separation. And now we all freely have access to God, whatever. But there are two curtains, not one. And none of the passage specify like it was the curtain to the Holy of Holies. In fact, if you look at what they do say, they all say the curtain of the temple. Well, the curtain of the temple would be kind of seem like the one on the front, wouldn't it? Because that's the curtain of the temple. So even though we kind of come to this conclusion that it says Holy of Holies, like it doesn't really say. It seems to be more in line that this front one would be the one. And if they said, you know, the curtain to the temple tore in two, if it was this one and this one was still up, how would you see that one tore? Only this small group of priests from the line of Aaron would have known anything about it. Right, so most modern Bible scholars have come to the belief, to the conclusion that the curtain that was torn in two would have been the curtain to the front of the temple. Now, the question may be, who cares? And that's a good point. That's a good question. That's a good assessment. But there is some significant stuff that's happening here, okay? So let's talk about the temple a little bit more. Now, the temple has always been understood to be like the dwelling place of God. Okay, as well as the meeting place of the divine and humans. If you look at the story of creation in Genesis chapter 2, the Garden of Eden is understood to be the dwelling place of God. Genesis chapter 2 says this, "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done." Now, when it talks about God resting, God isn't resting because God is like running out of energy. God resting is actually temple language. Okay, Dr. John Walton, professor of Old Testament at Wheaton College, he talks about this and he says this. Any ancient reader, Israelite or otherwise, would have understood that if Genesis talks about God resting, it talks about the temple because that is where God rests and where the gods rest. And that is why temples were built. Okay, so there's a ton of stuff that point to and support this idea that we don't have time for. But essentially, everything is a type of everything else. Everything is a parallel. Everything is symbolic. So all of creation was seen and understood to be God's temple. So creation was the temple of God. And then the garden where God was dwelling, where God rested with his creation, would be understood like the Holy of Holies. And so then Adam and Eve would be like, they were given this responsibility to care for this place, this dwelling place of God. They kind of become like this first priest. They're caring for the temple that is all of creation. They were the ones to take care of and maintain the dwelling place of God. So from the very beginning, there's this idea that all that is sacred space. It's all God's temple. Then, when you look at how the tabernacle and even how the temple were constructed, there are so many things that reference to or point to or serve to remind about the things of creation. Some even suggest that the way it was to be constructed was to mirror the 7 days of creation. Along with this, when you look at the layout of the temple was to be a microcosm of the universe. Okay, let's look at another little map here. Okay, this is like a top-down version. So this is, you know, the blue line. You can see that. That's the temple. So you have the courtyard. You have the holy place. You have the most holy place. Here you have the altar of sacrifice, the laver, candlestick, table showbread, altar of incense, and then the Ark of the Covenant all inside the veil of the most holy place. Now, when you start to look at this, the temple has three main areas, the outer court, the holy place, and the most holy place. And they each are like speaking to something else. So the outer court represents the physical realities of the world that we live in. You have the laver, that little circle there, that's like this big wash basin, and it was referred to as the sea. You can look this up in 1 Kings chapter 7 if you care, verse 23 through 26. And the priest would use to wash in this place. That represents the sea. You also have the altar of sacrifice, which in Exodus chapter 20, in verse 24, it talks about how this altar of sacrifice was to be an altar of earth or of uncut stone. So you have these like tangible earth elements. You have land and sea, or earth and water. Then you get to the holy place, and you have this candlestick, and this, the holy place has to do with the visible heavens and its light sources, like the stars and the planets. You have this candle with its seven candles. You've seen the menorah thing before. It represents wisdom and enlightenment, 7 days of creation. Some suggest that it represents the sun and the moon and then the five visible planets. Then you get into the Holy of Holies and up at the top there, which symbolizes the invisible dimensions of the cosmos, where God and the heavenly host dwell, a place where only the high priest could enter, only once a year. This was to be heaven on earth. This was to be the spiritual junction between heaven and earth. So the whole thing is the temple, and then the temple is a microcosm of the whole thing. It's really fascinating. There's also this Jewish tradition based on Ezekiel chapter 5, verse 5, which says this. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. This is Jerusalem, which I have set in the center of the nations, with countries all around her. So based on the tradition says that that the earth sits at the center of the universe, and Israel sits at the center of the earth, and Jerusalem sits at the center of Israel, and the Temple Mount sits at the center of Jerusalem, and the Holy of Holies sits at the center of the Temple Mount. So the idea is that the Holy of Holies was like the absolute center of all things, that in some ways, the very heart and center of the entirety of the universe. It's all sacred space. Along with this, this is also where it is believed the Holy of Holies, where it sat on the Temple Mount. Some believe that it was the place where God asked Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. Some believe that it's also the same place where man was formed from the dust of the earth. So the temple has like layer after layer after layer after layer after layer of significance. So three of the four Gospels say that the veil to the temple was torn in two in the moment that Jesus died. And we now believe that this is the outer veil rather than the inner veil to the Holy of Holies. Now, to understand the size of this, these veils, I don't know if you've ever looked into this before, but these were just like massive curtains. They were said to be like 32 to 34 feet wide. To give you an idea, I marked it off in tape. Follow me, camera guy. There we go. Okay, I'm off screen. From here, there's a little piece of tape here. You probably can't see it. From here, this is about 32 feet. We're walking slowly across the front of the room. Okay, you got me. To here, it's about 32 feet. So it was about that wide. And then it says it was like 65 to 80 feet tall. To give you perspective, from the floor here to our ceiling is 25 feet. So you're looking at double, triple, somewhere 2.5 times this, and it was 4 inches thick. This is a massive curtain. They said it took, there's writings that talk about how there were like it took 300 priests to hang it. 300 priests, if it would occasionally be made unclean, to take it down and clean it. So when it talks about the temple to the veil, veil to the temple being torn in two, this is not something that can be done by like man. This is something much, much bigger. Now, what's interesting is that we actually have a description of the outer veil, thanks to our good buddy and historian Josephus. I want you to look at this description of the outer veil. Okay. But before these doors, the doors of the temple, there was a veil of equal largeness with the doors. It was a Babylonian curtain, which is fascinating, embroidered with blue and fine linen and scarlet and purple, and of a contexture that was truly wonderful. Nor was this a mixture of colors without its mystical interpretation, but was a kind of image of the universe. For by the scarlet there seemed to be enigmatically signified fire, by the fine flax, the earth, by the blue, the air, and by the purple, the sea. Two of them having their colors, their foundation of this resemblance. but the fine flax and the purple having their own origin for that foundation, the earth producing one and the sea the other. This curtain had also embroidered upon it all that was mystical in the heavens, excepting that of the 12 signs representing living creatures. This is a beautiful curtain with all these colors that represent something of creation. Even the origins of some of the materials themselves represent creation. The earth and the sea, this whole giant curtain was this tapestry of the entirety of the heavens. And Mark says that that massive curtain was torn in two. Now, what you have to understand here is that Mark, at least, is up to something by identifying this curtain that sat in front of the temple doors with the picture of the heavens on it that was torn in two. Turn with me to Mark chapter 1. Mark chapter 1, verse 9. This is the very beginning of the story of the life, well, depending on which book you're at. Mark starts with the baptism of Jesus. At that time, Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. Just as Jesus was coming up out of the water, he saw heaven being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, "You are my son, whom I love. With you, I am well pleased." So Mark begins his gospel with the baptism of Jesus. And he says that just as Jesus was coming up out of the water, heaven was torn apart. The Spirit descends on him like a dove. God says, "This is my son, who I am well pleased." At the beginning of his career, heavens are torn, Spirit descends, "This is my son." At the end of his life, the curtain of the temple with the picture of the heavens are torn. They descend. What does the curtain, or what does the centurion say? The centurion says, "This man surely was the Son of God." So you have these events kind of bookmarking the ministry of Jesus. Now, also, we don't have time to go into this today, but if you look at the transfiguration plays into this in Mark chapter 9. It sits in the middle of these two events and actually kind of ties some things together. So you have the baptism, the transfiguration, and the death of Jesus. And all of these moments are like moments of extreme metamorphosis, extreme transformation. They're moments of boundary crossing and line blurring. Each of these moments gives birth to something new. The old is gone, the new is here. These moments where we see the Father and the Son mingling in the Spirit within our reality, reminding us that we are not alone, reminding us that God is over all and through all and in all. These moments that are inviting us into this whole new kind of reality. So maybe the question for us is, again, well, what's the point? What's the point? Well, there's a couple different ways to see and think and understand the crucifixion when you start to bring all this into play, okay? The first is this. One way to think about the crucifixion is through the lens of grief. In the Bible, when a father lost a son, when a son died, the way that the father would emote, the father would show his grief would be by tearing their garments, by ripping their outer garments, right? Like when Jacob was tricked by his sons that to believe that Joseph, his son, was dead. Genesis chapter 37. Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned for many days. So God has made this promise to the people of Israel that God would dwell among the people through the temple and the tabernacle. So the Holy of Holies is to believe to be the dwelling place of God. So then the outer, like the veil to the temple, would kind of serve as this like outer garment, wouldn't it? Kind of this picture that they're giving to the people. So when the veil is ripped in two, it's this picture of like a grief of a father who has lost his son. This is like a picture of God lamenting the death of his son, which is kind of an interesting thought. Well, the heavens are torn. This is part of who God is. Like there's a sadness to this thing. Another way to think of it would be through the lens of the triumphal the triumphal entry. Like we talked about earlier, that maybe Jesus wasn't just riding as a king, maybe he's also making a statement. Like his parade was also a protest against the Roman government who was oppressing God's people. And so because his whole message was about this new kind of kingdom, God's kingdom, it wasn't going to be a kingdom that would be built on might, on violence, on force, but rather it was going to be a kingdom that was built on peace. And so because of this third way nonviolent resistance, he ends up being executed by the state. But in doing so, he takes that violence of the empire into himself and he brings an end to the cycle of violence. And although it seems as though at first as though the empire may have won, the revolution of peace and love and forgiveness and mercy and new life is just getting started. And so there's kind of this example, maybe even for us, for how do we deal with injustice in the world? There's other ways. In fact, there was this, I just read this story. It's absolutely fascinating. It's in my notes, so I got to go quick. So pay attention. There was this town in Germany where every year since like the 1980s, there would be this big neo-Nazi rally, which is like interesting because they were coming to celebrate the death of a high-ranking Nazi, whatever. And so it was buried in this town. And so all these neo-Nazis would show up and they would do this march through this little town and just kind of looking to cause problems and like prove a point, whatever, hooray. And so the townspeople like every year were like, what the heck, man, these guys keep showing up. We don't know what to do about it. So this guy had an idea and he said, what if we turn it into a charity race? They're like, what do you mean? So they came up with this idea. So they went around the town and said, hey, next year when they show up, here's what we're gonna do. We're all gonna pledge, we're gonna pledge to donate money for every meter that they walk. And then we're gonna give that money to a charity, to a cause that helps people get out of extremist group. And so the big day came and they put a start line and they put a finish line and they held banners and they blew confetti and they were cheering on the neo-Nazis. You can do it. You can do it. And they're like, what's happening? Like they had nothing to fight against. And they turned the whole thing into this beautiful moment. And they raised $20,000 to help get people out of groups like that. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Right? You couldn't have done that with weapons. Do you know what I'm saying? Everybody won, except the Nazis. They didn't know what was happening. They were just confused. Keep going. What? Like, it's fascinating to me. So anyways, yeah. We can also look at this through the lens of like a cosmic event. Mark speaks about the heavens being torn at the baptism of Jesus. Then at his death, the veil of the temple, which is this picture of the heavens, is torn in two. Along with that, Luke and Matthew, they talk about like how darkness is coming over the land and the sun stops shining and the earth is shaking and the rocks are splitting and the tombs are being opened and dead people are coming back to life, which raises a whole bunch of other questions. So from the heavens to the sun, to the rocks, to the earth, to the people that were being covered by the earth, it's all being affected. This was an extraordinary event. Nothing is not affected in this moment. It's this massive, global, universal, cosmic event that's all moving towards transformation. And then, of course, we can talk about this through the lens of the eternal Christ, who is in all and through all and over all, the one who is all and is in all. When we look at the crucifixion through the lens of the eternal Christ, there's something quite comforting and hopeful and personal about it. Two things to point out here. The first is this. Through the lens of the eternal Christ, the tearing of the heavens, the tearing of the veil, actually seems to fit in line with the expansive and inclusive nature of the Christ. In Exodus, God tells the people, you're going to be for me a kingdom of priests. When you get into 1 Peter, 1 Peter says this, as you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans, but chosen by God and precious to him. You also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood. To be a holy priesthood. Offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Look at what Hebrews says. Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, so Jesus has now become our high priest, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weakness, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, and yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. So Jesus has become this high priest, and then we have been invited to be a part of the priesthood. And we ourselves are these living stones built into this temple, which is the dwelling place of God. And we ourselves are this temple, which is the dwelling place of God. And so when the veil is torn in two, there's this opening and this expanding. Prior to this, it was only the priests from the line of Aaron that were allowed to enter into the holy place. This holy place that was covered by the veil. And only the high priest was allowed to enter into the Holy of Holies. And so now Jesus steps into the role of the high priest. And now this role that was only limited to a certain group is now being expanded. We're all invited into the holy place to work and serve the temple, to work and maintain, to expand the temple, this dwelling place of God, the meeting place for man and God. Like, do you see, like, the Christ is always expanding and including. A second thing here is this. Through the lens of the eternal Christ, who is over all, through all, and in all, the crucifixion speaks to more than just Jesus suffering. It speaks to the suffering of all. There's a Jewish teaching that talks about how if injustice is somewhere, the whole earth is off kilter. So the crucifixion, through the lens of the eternal Christ, speaks to not just the suffering of Jesus, but to the suffering of all beings. Right? If you think about it, in John 1, it says, in the beginning, he was in the beginning and all things were made through him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Colossians 3, Christ is all and is in all. God is over all, through all, and in all. You see, the crucifixion reminds us that we are not alone in this. Jesus, who was sinless, suffered. And if Jesus, who was sinless, suffered, that's not fair. It would suggest to me that all of us, none of us are immune to suffering. But what's so great about this is, like, when you look at that passage from Hebrews 14, we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with us. We have someone who's been through it, who's walked with us, who's been tempted as we have been tempted. He says, yeah, now, because of this, we can approach God's throne with grace and confidence that we may receive mercy, we may find grace in our time of need. And none of us are immune from suffering. And so what the crucifixion does is that it reminds us that it's like this setup. It's the setup for the thing to come. It's the suffering that actually leads to this death and then resurrection. So there's a bit of comfort here knowing that, one, we are not alone. Two, that the Christ who is in us also suffers, so we don't have to walk through it alone. And three, that this thing that we're dealing with is actually has the potential to lead to, like, a whole new thing. And so I think that's part of the beauty and the mystery and the wonder and the gratitude that we have for the crucifixion. Because it may seem like Rome has won. It may seem like our the things in our life become too overwhelming. Like, we can't get beyond it. I just can't move through this. This is too much. I don't know what to do with all this pain. But when you begin to understand this through the lens of the eternal Christ, who's over all, through all, and in all, it allows us to have this thought that Christ is so ingrained to all things that there is nothing outside of that. There's nothing outside of it, which means that even our suffering can be used for something good. Even our suffering does not win. Even our suffering does not define who we are. Even our suffering can be transformed into something beautiful. And I think, to me, that's the hope, part of the hope of the crucifixion, that God has sent his son out of his love to remind us of his love, to show us there's a different way, there's a whole different thing that can happen, to let us know that, hey, I'm with you, I can relate, I can understand that, you can come to me with your problems, your worries, your cares, I get that, let me help you. And to know that also, whatever it is you're going through, that this is not the end. It may feel like it some days. It may feel like Rome has won. It may feel like the crucifixion is going to take it. It's not the end. It's not the end. It's the setup for something new and beautiful and wonderful.
Well, thank you for that message, Seth. I don't know about you, but I was particularly sort of moved and struck, maybe, by the idea of the crucifixion as, you know, yes, it's Jesus dying on behalf of humanity, according to the scriptures. It's this, you know, fulfillment of God's plan to some extent. But as a symbol for us, as an example for us of choosing nonviolence, even at great personal cost, even when it means great pain and suffering for us, but as a way to demonstrate to the world our faith, our hope is real, that it's not something that we lean on until we have to solve things with violence. But no, we trust that nonviolence, this, the third way, is the best way, that that is what God wills for humanity. He wills for us to live peacefully with one another, and to embody that even to the point of death on a cross is it's just so powerful. So I hope it was a powerful thing for you as well. We hope that we'll see you. If you listen to this before Friday and you're local to our area, we're going to do a Good Friday at Labyrinth on Good Friday this year. It's March 29th from 6 to 8 p.m. That'll be here at our building. And again, if you're listening to this before Friday, if you're local, it's not a two-hour service. It's kind of a drop-by sort of thing. Come and spend a little bit of time praying and meditating, walking through this labyrinth that we're going to be creating. And then, of course, Easter Sunday, next Sunday morning, we'll be here at our normal time, 10 a.m. And we'll have a bunch of extra seats for you and your friends and your family and your neighbors. So we hope that we'll see you there. Until then, though, that'll do it for this episode of the Foundry Church Podcast. We love you. We'll see you next week.